So this question, are the three root defilements all different types of craving? Could you please explain the relationship between craving and the three root defilements? So the three root defilements, I assume that they're referring to greed, hatred, and delusion. Those are said to be the three roots of all unskillful actions and the root of ignorance. And they give rise to, virtually every form of craving and attachment. But ignorance or delusion, which is in the Pali word, the word is either, they use avidya, which means ignorance, and or moha, which means delusion. Delusion means, basically means not understanding the truth. Not understanding the Four Noble Truths, but essentially not understanding the mind. What the mind is, how it operates, how it gets caught up in suffering and conflicts. And the root delusion is the delusion of self, or I, that I talked about this morning. It's attached itself to consciousness. And so we have that sense of I am, the owner of this mind. And I'm the one that's seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. I'm the one that's angry. I'm the one that's happy or sad. And, there's three manifestations of that. The ego. Basically, that's the three aspects of the ego are I, me, and mine. It means every single thing that comes through our senses, that delusion or ignorance is relating them as I am this, or this is I, or me, give it to me, look at me, and mine, this is mine, that clinging. So I, me, and mine, that's kind of the trinity of ignorance. And that's behind every single thought and impulse, basically, that comes through. And so because of that, craving for pleasurable feeling and aversion and hatred for painful feelings arises. Because again, it's the ego that wants desire and happiness and pleasurable feeling. And to be a rid of the painful feeling. And so that basically gives rise to every conceivable form of attachment and desire and craving. Now there is one sort of, kind of desire that's not so bad, and that's the desire to end desire. So normally, you read in the text that craving is the cause of suffering, but actually, ignorance is the deepest root cause of suffering. But craving and aversion is the manifestation, is the activity of the ignorance. Because it's the clinging that we have to those objects. But there's one kind of desire that's considered to be okay, and that's the desire to reach the end of desire. Or the desire to meditate. The desire to try to improve oneself. These are considered okay, even though they're still desires. You can't be totally free from desires, Only when you reach the third stage of enlightenment only, you will be totally free from any types of sensual desires. But so we have to recognize that the types of desires that bring the strongest painful effects, and those are the, you know, the sensual type of desires, a craving for beautiful objects to see, and smells, tastes, and the pleasurable body feelings. So we crave that, you know, erotic kind of sensations, and we develop that kind of craving. Because again, as I mentioned today, it's a way of getting away from the painful feelings. Most people have an overabundance or majority of painful feelings. And to try to get away from them, they try to create pleasant feelings, such as indulging in sensual pleasures, alcohol, drugs, any number of things. So, you know, basically, you know, the relationship is that all cravings come from those three root defilements. And the opposite of those three root defilements, there's opposite ones. So greed, hatred, and delusion produce the suffering, but the opposites, that means non-greed, non-hatred, and wisdom, these bring more, you know, pleasant feeling and happiness. Because when the mind is operating from the positive roots, what are called the wholesome roots of non-greed, non-hatred, or loving friendliness, compassion, and wisdom, that means weakening one's selfish-centered preoccupation, opening up to the larger world, then that brings, at least it doesn't bring so much direct painful effects. And it leads to the causes of happiness. So basically in our practice of Dhamma, that's what we're, you know, that we try to do in following the Noble Eightfold Path. You know, the following right effort, that's the, you know, the sixth step of the Noble Eightfold Path, right effort, the effort to prevent and abandon unwholesome states from dominating your mind, and the efforts to cultivate the wholesome, those wholesome states, and to develop them so they become more automatic. So you can't have both in the mind at the same time. You can't have both an unwholesome thought and a wholesome thought in the mind at the same time. So the effort and practice is to try to, you know, by being mindful of the unwholesome thoughts of greed, hatred, and delusion, and not reacting to them, we have a little bit of time to then cultivate the wholesome opposites to that. So like if you're starting to get angry because somebody's disturbing you, say you're trying to meditate and your mind's getting very quiet, and then all of a sudden, you know, somebody next to you is going and, you know, you can notice that, that ego contracting, and the person goes on, maybe if they just once or twice you could forget about it, but, you know, they might go on longer and longer, and you can see this anger, ill thoughts arise. So to cut that off, you then reflect, well, this person is ill, they have, you know, something wrong, or they're unmindful, it's not their fault. You know, I do the same thing sometimes. These things happen to me also. So instead of cultivating anger toward them, you develop compassion toward them. Thoughts, may they be free from their throat irritation, may they be free from their cold, may they cultivate more mindfulness to resist making so much noise or distractions. So that way you counter the unwholesome thoughts with the substitution of the wholesome thoughts. and that it be, so it becomes more automatic. So whenever you see a thought of greed, hatred, and delusion arising, you counter it with thoughts of non-greed, compassion, loving-kindness, and wisdom. This next question, how to reverse the process of being self or I? Ah, that's the million-dollar question. Well, as we just mentioned, the thought of self and I comes from ignorance. That means not knowing the truth about the mind. And we learn it because we grow up in these societies where everything is self, self, self. Me, I, mine. We learn that from a very young age. And we see everyone else acting in this way too. You know, be all you can be. Go after, get what you want. And so it's you know, programmed into us from, you know, day one, more or less. And so, you know, it's very difficult to reverse that process. And some people, it gets out of control and they want more power and they want to dominate others and their greed just knows no bounds. They're not even satisfied with the, you know, $1 million. They have to have 5 million or 10 million, mm-hmm. or billions. So, the only way to reverse the process is Dhamma. Actually, the practice of Dhamma is nothing but doing that. The practice of Dana, the practice of Sila, the practice of Bhavana, meditation, they're all designed at weakening the strong grasping of I, me, and mine. Like the practice of generosity. So you know, offer something to charity. You know, somebody who's miserly means, well, I'm going to keep that. You know, I want it for myself. You know, what can I do with it? You know, keep everything for myself. And so, you know, that you know, strengthens the sense of self. But when you give and you share with others, it helps to open up this this contraction of the heart. You know, this this self contraction. The feeling of self actually is a contraction. And the letting go of the self is an expansion. And you can directly observe that, you know, in your mind during meditation. It's in at certain times, especially when there's a painful feeling, you can see how the body contracts around it. And the sense of I and struggling against it. You can see that very clearly. But when you relax and open up, just allow those painful feelings to kind of reverberate through and everything, and you kind of keep the awareness more open, then that sense of self then is not so strong. And so, you know, basically, you know, reversing the process of self is reducing greed, hatred, and delusion. And it's done through, you know, the practice of Dhamma, following the Noble Eightfold Path, and all those different aspects of training. Of course, a lot of people, you know, they hear this idea about, you know, reducing the self, and they're afraid that, you know, they're not going to be able to function or something like that, or, you know, people are going to walk all over them, you know, and they have to exert them, you know, exert themselves, you know, defend themselves against all these negative energies that come at you in the world. And that's true. We have to have a wholesome attitude of the self. You can't just immediately get rid of the idea of self, because that also only comes with the stages of enlightenment. but you can reduce the strength of that ego grasping. And its strength is the craving and the aversion. So the more you gradually kind of let go or weaken the force of craving and the anger and hatred, then that sense of I also then becomes a little bit more open and not so contracted. So it's easier to work on reducing greed and hatred than working directly on the ego. Because greed and hatred is the food for the self. So you remove the food. Like you stop feeding the dog, neighbor's dog. Keeps coming around. As long as you feed the dog, he keeps coming back. If you stop feeding it, it might come back a few times, but gradually he says, this person's useless, you know. Go somewhere else. But people think they won't enjoy anything. But actually you'll enjoy things much, much more. Because when you lose something, the mind won't be so affected by it. And you can enjoy things in the moment, but without that grasping at them to hold. And in the Dhamma, it's not about we're trying to deny any type of pleasure. There's many pleasurable feelings. Especially in meditation, there's many pleasurable feelings that you can experience. And even in just the day-to-day life. You know, sure, there's pleasurable feelings that arise, you know, say some tasty food, nice sounds, things like that. There are pleasant feelings. The Buddha said that. But if you can just, if they come to you naturally, or innocently, you know, just kind of come to you, you can enjoy it in the moment. Okay, but you're aware, okay, this is a pleasurable feeling. And you're aware as long as it lasts, you don't try to push it away. Okay, this is a pleasurable feeling. But when it's gone, you don't want to grab it and bring it back, because it's gone. And you don't think about it. How am I going to get that again in the future? So when you start planning and scheming, how are you going to get that pleasurable feeling again in the future? That means you have attachment. But if you can enjoy a pleasurable feeling in the present moment, and you haven't done anything to get it in a bad way, you haven't stolen, lying, broken any precepts in order to get that feeling, it comes to you naturally. Somebody invites you over to the house for dinner and they make some nice, delicious food, okay. It's a pleasurable feeling, you can feel it. But knowing that it's impermanent, it arises because of a cause and it ceases. When the cause is over, it ceases. In the same way for painful feeling too. You endure the painful feeling with patience, knowing that it's also impermanent, without trying to push it away, because it will also cease. So in those ways, those are ways that we gradually reduce the strength of the, keep building up the sense of Bye-bye. It says, during the Dhamma talk today, you seem to define greed and aversion as one of the five aggregates. Yet in some traditions, the defilements are considered as separate from the aggregates. I was taught that the defilements reside in the citta. Could you please clarify? The defilements, greed and aversion, are you know, their sankhara, their reactions to feeling and perception. And that's the aggregate, that's included in the aggregate of sankhara khanda, includes virtually everything, including greed and hatred. They're the reactions. We have a painful feeling. So first you feel a painful feeling. And you recognize, oh, that painful feeling is in my body. And then the I wants to get rid of it. That's a kind of a hatred when you don't like that. You want to get rid of it. So that's a sankhara, it's a habit. Because it can be changed. Just like in practicing metta, you can change this sankhara of anger by cultivating metta. You can weaken that sankhara of anger and cultivate the positive sankhara of metta. So, you know, it's because, you know, so it's included in the aggregate of the sankhara, mental factors. That's why in the Cittanupassana, Satipatthana Sutta, you know, you recognize when the mind has a hatred in it, the mind with hate. It's a citta, but the citta itself has no quality. It's colored by the sankhara. Consciousness has no defining characteristics. It's defined by the type of sankhara that's driving the consciousness, that's within the consciousness. So we call it a consciousness with hate, or consciousness with non-hate, or consciousness with love, whatever. It's because that sankhara of dvesh, or hatred, or anger, or whatever it is coloring it. It's like water. Let's say you have a bowl of water, and you put red dye into it. And somebody who had never seen water before thinks water is red. But no, water is not red. So the same way, our consciousness is basically clean. But it's the defilements, the delusion adds the element of I into the consciousness. Greed adds the element of greed into it. And hatred adds the element of hatred into it. So greed and aversion per se is, you know, just part of the larger aggregate of sankhara. Do you have any suggestions on how to grieve over the loss of a parent? Sometimes meditation works to help reduce the grief. Is it better to be active to forget the loss? Now, the loss of loved ones, especially the parents, so there's usually a very strong karmic bond of parents and the children, stronger than any other types of bonds, because basically, you know, you're springing right from the womb of the mother. And so there's certain types of karmic energies that, you know, attracted you to be born to that mother in that family. Could be from past life acquaintances or some unfinished types of business and so on, that you were karmically drawn back to be born in a particular place. Maybe not all the time, but at least you can read in the Buddhist text so many instances of that, where families, people in families were born again in the same family and had to work out their various hate relationships or love-hate relationships and so on. So the grief that one experiences, you know, grief is a, you know, is an emotion. It's not all bad. And it's a process that everyone goes through, but it comes from attachment, of course. There's a Dhammapada verse, from attachment springs grief. From attachment springs fear. And if there's no attachment, then why would there be grief or fear? Again, everything comes back to attachment. So everyone has attachment naturally to their parents in one form or another. Especially if, you know, you had a good relationship with them and so on, there'd be the grief. So grief is more or less a natural human emotion. And it takes time for most people to overcome that. And you can't just deny that. You can't deny the grief. Because if you do, it will go kind of buried and they become suppressing the grief, which could then come out in later on in different negative effects of that. So you experience the grief and know that, okay, this is grief. And knowing that somewhat is again, until we attain at least the second stage of enlightenment, we're going to always have a certain amount of these emotions arising: greed, hatred, grief, sorrow, the whole range. Because they're so deep rooted. But we can stop adding to the grief and refueling it by our maintenance of wisdom. So when the grief arises, you notice the sadness, you remember, some person. And, so you see it as just a habit reaction. It's a sankara. It's just a habit reaction. And you see, it produces maybe some tears well up. And you try to just observe it objectively. Okay, this body is remembering a certain person, because of this attachment, the tears, come up and drop down. But you understand it for what it is. But you don't keep building it up. Oh, you start to, bringing back all kinds of thoughts about the person, or bringing up the memories and kind of stirring it up. You kind of just feel what that grief is doing in the body, what kind of heaviness or what kind of any other sort of sensations. That's why tuning into the body and getting close to body sensations is a very good way to help to identify various types of emotions and to see how they are affecting the body and be aware of those rather than focusing on the content that caused the grief. And then as you're not increasing it, it gradually will get less and less. But anyway, it's natural that you will have that for a certain amount of time. And for every person, that's going to be different. And as in my own case, my father died about 12 years ago, I think. So I was here in Washington at the time. He's out in California. And my mother called, and said, well, your father may not live out the weekend. And so I got a flight, I got a flight and I went back. So I hoped to try to be there, to be with him in the last few hours or whatever. I was too late. He died before I could get there. I noticed some sort of emotion coming. I just felt some kind of, I felt some sensation, and it kind of caused one tear to kind of well up, because this is just a mental, physical kind of reaction. The tear came up, and I just realized, it was an inherent kind of, just remembering the father, the good father and all that, and we had basically a good relationship and all that. But of course, my training, being a monk for so long and training in this, it wasn't very strong, but I did notice that one tear came up, it dropped, and then it was over, it was finished. But so, you know, it's all a matter of training. When you understand that the death is natural, and no one can escape the death, and we shouldn't, the person who has died in most cases, they were probably in some state of suffering, and they themselves probably wanted to die. I know my father wanted to die because he was stuck in a body, he could no longer walk and this and that. And so I grieve. We're grieving because of the attachment, not for that person. That person may want to pass away, and we're not, we're trying to not allow them to. Anyway, these are, complicated sort of emotions. And usually in the case of a husband and wife, in many cases it takes years for that grief to gradually go away. But again, individual cases are different. But usually it just gradually, just like the leaves in the fall, when the energy gets taken away from the leaves in the fall, then they start to change color, and they lose their grip from the tree and eventually fall down. So in the same way, when we're able to cultivate our mindfulness and wisdom, and learn how to observe the rise and fall of the aggregates, and apply this wisdom of impermanence, and it's not really me or mine, it's just conditioned phenomenon, then we're not adding more fuel to that, and they gradually lose their power and eventually fall out of the mind. So sometimes in meditation, when we can observe these different emotions more quickly, as soon as they start to arise, if we can have our mindfulness on them, then they are easier to kind of reflect on and to let it go. Various emotions, such as attachment and aversion, anger, or grief, or any other types of emotions. It's sort of like an octopus. If an octopus gets one tentacle on you like that, you can usually, gradually pry off the tentacle and it goes away. So that's if your mindfulness is very quick. If you're well grounded in the present moment and in touch with the nervous system, start to notice these things, you're starting to get angry. Anger. And kind of detach from it, or observe it. You lose its power. It's like knocking the wind out of it, because the power of the mindfulness. But if your mindfulness is a little slow, it gets two tentacles on you, then still, with a little extra effort, you can get them on. But if you're slower still and it gets three of them on you, that means you've already started to produce a bunch of follow-up thoughts related to this particular emotion. The domino effect, and then the slower your mindfulness is to react, or the weaker your wisdom is, then that thing will get, once it gets like five or six or seven tentacles on you, then it's very difficult to get it off. So that's why the mindfulness is really the most powerful mental faculty for dealing with whatever types of defilements or negative emotions, feelings are arising, to have that mindfulness there, to sort of nip it in the bud, so to speak, when it's still just very weak. or when a thought emerges, you start to think, you get lost in thinking. You get lost in thinking sometimes, right? And totally not aware that you're of your body anymore. Totally lost in some thought for maybe a couple minutes. Because you didn't see the thought coming. Right? Now here you are sitting there trying to, breathing in, sitting, breathing out, sitting in. But then this thought, like a very clever thief, they sneak in the back door, and they put a bag over our head because we're unmindful. So I like to use the analogy of watching television. You're sitting on your couch watching some drama. And you're totally engrossed in that and you lose awareness of, the present moment, and you're, rooting for the Cowboys and Indians or whatever it is. Getting engrossed in that. And you don't hear some car drive up and park in front of the house. You don't hear the neighbors or your own dog barking. Well, you do, but too attached. You want to watch a show. And you don't hear him climbing over your back fence. And then jimmying your window. He sneaks in the window, steals all your sterling silver. And you weren't aware of that. And then goes out. Because you had no mindfulness. You weren't centered and grounded in the present moment because of the strong attachment to whatever you were doing, or lost in your thoughts. Your attention wasn't able to pick up these signals, early warning signals. But instead, if you're sitting on the TV, maybe you're watching TV or something, but still you had part of your mind attached, feeling the body. You still had some awareness. Because it can be done, actually. And so that then when you heard, when you heard somebody coming up, you said, oh, somebody's coming up. I wonder who they are. It's too late for friends. And then they get out and you hear the dog barking. My dog wouldn't bark at my friends. And so you start to think. Then you hear them climbing over the back fence. Oh, my friends wouldn't climb over the back fence. So you get alerted. You go to the back door and you kind of stand by the back door, the back window. This person is opening the window and climbing in. And you put a bag over his head. You call the cops. And that is how mindfulness works. To catch the thief, to catch Mara. Mara is the delusions in our mind that are always trying to make us lose our mindfulness and make us get caught up in unskillful thoughts and actions because we're unmindful. So in that way, and it's because our attention is not grounded deep in the body, in the nervous system, or it's not resting in the present moment. But when it is, you can see these first impulses of thought, and that mindfulness will be strong enough to knock the power out of it. Because it's impermanent also. The thoughts are impermanent, they just arise in a moment and would vanish. But because of our attachment, we keep on regenerating the thought over and over and over again and get spun out in so many ways because we didn't see it in the first instance. But if you can see it in the first instance with wisdom, mindfulness and wisdom, then it's like a laser beam. Wisdom is like a laser beam that cuts it out. So it's called the power of mindfulness and the power of wisdom. It acts as a laser beam to burn up any defilements of the mind, burn up delusion, attachment and aversion. Okay, there's one last question. This is kind of related to this. It says, my main fear or reluctance of dying is the sadness it will bring to my family. How can I rectify this mindset? I guess that means if you yourself are, you know, suffering from some kind of a terminal illness, and your family is very, you know, upset about it, and, you know, even though the doctors say there's, you know, not much hope or so, the parents are worrying themselves sick, or, you know, trying to do everything they can to consult the most expensive clinicians, and you know, trying to resort to every new type of therapy. And so we feel sad that our parents are sad. Now maybe you have a knowledge of Dhamma, and maybe you yourself have accepted more or less the fate. Although when we have a terminal illness, it's like we don't just do nothing about it. If we can, you know, because, you know, life is valuable. We want to keep the life process going as long as possible so that we can make further progress in our Dhamma practice. That means ideally to attain at least the first stage of realization. So, you know, we don't want this body to die prematurely, but it will in many instances. But we can do what we can, but at a certain point, you know, there's not much else one can do. Or people might want to prolong their life for 2 more months or 3 more months. Even if they're kind of, you know, incapacitated and so on and suffering. Or the parents want to hold on. And the person themselves might want to die, but the family doesn't want them to die. So it's kind of selfishness on the family's part, actually. But again, that comes because of their love for you or whatever ulterior motives and so on might be there. And the same is true with euthanasia and, you know, pulling the plug and should you do this or that kind of things. And we'll talk about those later maybe. But anyway, you know, if your family is not into Dhamma, they don't understand the Dhamma, then it's very difficult to try to change their mind. But through your own acceptance of it and so on, then that's probably the best way for them to gradually relax around it. And if they see that you've totally accepted it, and have stopped struggling about it, and not want to, you know, cause them worry and fear, then, you know, that's about, you know, all we can do really, is by our own example. You know, what if they have some chance to hear the Dhamma or something that, you know, will help them? That's why the Dhamma is really the best medicine. Dhamma is medicine. Meditation is medicine. They come from the same root, M-E-D-I, you know, to heal, to mediate between ignorance and wisdom. Meditation helps to heal ignorance, and the greed and attachments and aversions in the mind based on the ignorance. But again, it takes a long time for that to gradually develop. So anyway, you shouldn't have fear or reluctance of dying, because, you know, the parents, they have their own karma, and they're going to have to, you know, they're going to experience sadness or grief, but that's the way of the world. Everyone does that. So you shouldn't prolong your own misery necessarily or feel sad or reluctant, because they're suffering. They have their own karma to work out. And hopefully your illness and passing away will help them to, just as you might have done before, you know, sought out the Dhamma to help answer some of your questions about, you know, the difficulties in life. So the same way your parents might. So, you know, a lot of people do come to the Dhamma through the loss of their loved ones, maybe even some of you also. and helped you to, you know, try to find some answers to these issues. And the same way with our parents, we're going to have to do that too. So, you know, you can have compassion instead of having fear of the dying or reluctance, have, you know, loving kindness and compassion for your parents if they, you know, have this kind of things. Because it's natural for parents to have that. And you can't force them not to have it. The same way as you can't force yourself not to have grief when one of your loved one dies, it'll gradually wear off. Because the nature of things is impermanent. Life goes on. Every single big catastrophe in the world, life goes on. The tsunami in Sri Lanka killed 20, 30, 40, 50,000 people. Or all, you know, life goes on. Things get rebuilt. People grieve. They overcome that, their life has to carry on. And that's really the, you know, the strength of the Dhamma. Is like a life preserver. Somebody's drowning, you throw them a life preserver, right? And they can hold on to that and kind of keep afloat. So, you know, the knowledge of the Dhamma and the practice of Dhamma and meditation is sort of like that life preserver. Until we learn how to swim. Okay, so I think that will be enough.